Director?
Yeah, we are, Madam Chair.
Okay, good morning. Even though I didn't get to finish the trip yesterday, I certainly enjoyed the first part, and I will never again complain about the mail I receive. every day.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Representative.
I enjoyed it also very much. Thank you for that opportunity.
Oh, thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Elizabeth Harshenko, Director of your Department of Revenue. With me today is my deputy, Jim Maneri, and Monica Brown, our analyst from the Department of Administrative Services. Madam Chair, you are always welcome to come and finish the tour. The really exciting part is the banking room, and you miss that.
I miss that.
So,
anything to do with money, I really enjoy.
Okay. I think Monica's going to begin with her overview.
Okay. Go ahead, Monica.
Good morning, Madam Chair, member of the committee. For the record, Monica Brown with the Department of Administrative Services.
And that's this packet?
Yes. I'm going to walk you through that all-too-familiar packet. The governor's recommended budget for the Department of Revenue is $137.7 million, includes 1,045 positions and 949.37 full-time equivalents. The department's budget is largely supported through the general fund, with approximately 14% coming from other funds received through administering collections for other agencies, timber revenue, and mass transit taxes, and several other smaller revenues. The governor's budget is an 8.3% increase over 99-2001, legislatively approved. It continues all major programs in the department, does change the staffing mix and takes advantage of some efficiencies that have been gained over the last two biennia, and adds resources to improve tax education and compliance, resulting in increased revenue collection. The Department of Revenue has nine program units, with the four largest, which include information processing, personal tax and compliance division, property tax and business division, account for approximately 90% of their budget. As we seen yesterday, a lot of their work is very staff intensive, so as you may expect, personal services accounts for about 70% of their budget. In arriving at the governor's recommended budget, we first adjust for any emergency board actions that occurred in the current biennium. For this agency, that includes employee compensation cost increases, the cost of processing and issuing the 1999 surplus kicker rebates, implementing information systems, and establishing positions and limitations for legislation that passed in 1999 session that didn't go through Ways and Means. We then adjust for anticipated actions in 2103, and for this agency, that includes, again, adjusting for position and inflationary costs on services, supplies, and capital outlay. And we did phase out the cost of processing and issuing a kicker rebate, because at this point, we don't know whether there will be a kicker. And typically, as you heard yesterday, if a kicker rebate is required, they will be back before an emergency board to finance that. The governor's budget includes nine policy packages that I will cover briefly here, and the agency will go into more detail later. The first is package 090, which is a program reduction, and again, it's recognizing efficiencies through automation in the last two biennia and changes to the timber privilege and harvest tax programs. Package 140 increases assistance and training to counties and local governments. Package 141 expands the ORMAP, digital-based mapping system. Package 142 increases limitation to expand the lien document processing fees for those documents that need to be reported for the senior and disabled tax program. The next four packages, 160 through 260, increase education and enforcement in the cigarette tax, personal tax, and business tax sections. And the final package, 330, increases beyond the standard inflation factor for the postage increase that occurred in January. And finally, in March, the governor did revise his budget, and he is adding additional 16 positions to expand, again, the enforcement, education, and assistance to citizens in the personal and business tax areas, and at this point we anticipate that an additional 7.9% gross revenue will be collected through the addition of those positions. And that concludes my remarks, Madam Chair, and take questions if you'd like.
Okay, thank you, Monica. Any questions, Monica? Director, if you want to go ahead.
Okay. Madam Chair, yesterday we concluded the very high-level overview, the sort of the flight over the Alps. And today, I've asked Jim Maneri, the deputy, to take you through the productivity piece of the overview presentation, which begins on page 1-37 in your presentation materials.
Thank you. Madam Chair, Representative Hayden, I'm Jim Maneri, the Deputy Director. I'll cover an overview of productivity, which is the main focus of our agency, and it's at the base of a lot of our packages and our base budget. Following that, the number of the division administrators will come and give you more detail about their programs and parts of the packages especially that you'd be interested in. Productivity is, as we go through this, you'll see that especially like on the tour of the processing center yesterday, over the 90s, even though the volume has increased coming through that processing center, we've decreased the number of hours that it takes to process because of our productivity. That in the 90s, there are people that are collecting revenues have increased their productivity by over 50% and 40% in terms of closing cases. We've done this by with a level number of positions during the 90s. We've changed our staff mix to do this. We've used automation. We've moved a lot more to teams, and we've used partnerships with other agencies and groups to sort of leverage that. So, saying that, going to page 1-38, these basically tell that story. There's the processing center workload, and that represents actually a lot of the programs have their volumes coming through there, their documents, their returns. All the programs have seen an increase. Over on the property tax system, as a measure of that, our two big programs are doing the big industrial appraisals and the utility appraisals. Those workloads also have increased with a steady staff without increase. Over on page 1-40, again, overall agency, we've had the workload increases, but as you can see through the 90s, we've done that with pretty much the same staffing level. We have changed our mix during the 90s, and our mix has been a strategy of moving from, actually, go over to page 1-42 and 43. The graph on 43 shows you really what's happened is basically because of technology, and of the strategy with our managers, we've reduced our clerical support as we've automated. We also dropped our manager level almost in half and went to a much flatter structure, and that enabled us to increase our frontline people, a number of appraisers and auditors and revenue agents to balance that out to deliver more service and productivity. But we've also had to increase our computer staff to support that, and we think that's been a good business strategy for us. And on 1-45, we have engaged in a number of partnerships that have helped us to deliver better services to Oregonians and to deal with better costs. We've had a program for a while now with the Department of Employment and Consumer and Business Services and others on combined reporting, payroll reporting. And one of the major goals of that was for the employers reporting to try to reduce all of the forms they had to file. It used to be they file with employment, with us on withholding. They had to file a separate TriMet or a Lane County Transit form, and we've combined that into one to where they can do that. And that's been the result of this partnership. On the back end of that, we've split up the duties to where employment actually processes the forms and enters the data and then moves it over to us where we handle the money and distribute the revenues. So we've shared our workload there to make that work. We've had a relationship with the IRS over the years, particularly to try to deliver services to taxpayers. So as they've come out with electronic programs, we've let them work the bugs out, like electronic filing, and then we piggyback so now that a taxpayer can file electronically once, and that information goes both to the IRS and then to us to file their returns. Next year we'll be doing that same thing with telephone filing. So for those that want to file with the telefile program, it'll work for both the federal and for the state of Oregon. The other thing we've done is exchanged information. We'll exchange audit information, and that way a taxpayer, in effect, isn't audited twice on the same thing. If the IRS has an audit scheduled, then we won't schedule that audit. We'll let them go ahead and do it so that they aren't doubled up. We do have an initiative on community outreach. We've been doing that, but we're going to intensify that, and you'll hear a little more about that later. And that's to try to reach taxpayers. We have a strong belief that the flow of revenue to our system over time is partly based on taxpayers understanding our system and trying to help them file and comply. So we're doing more outreach. We have another agency collection program where we provide collection services for other state agencies, which provides efficiencies for them. There are a number of other things. I'll mention the latest in terms of the going back to the joint payroll program and the partners we have there. We're now engaged with some of those same partners in building a portal. So we want to go to the web strategy to deliver even better services to businesses in the state. And then I'd like to say a few things about a new program we have on 1-47, which we call ORMAP. Last session, the legislature added to a document fee $1. These are all the documents filed with county clerks statewide. And that dollar goes into a fund, and the department's charged with basically building a statewide electronic mapping base. And this is much more than traditional maps. This is technology that's exploded during the 90s. And it's basically, we think, it's going to be a very helpful infrastructure piece for Oregon. This is the base. You take the taxpayer maps are important because it's basically, it goes down to the ground level with your ownerships. Assessors need them for property tax purposes, but the ownership information is valuable for a lot of other things. For instance, even within county government, if you build this base, it creates efficiencies for government because the assessor's office not only can use it, but planning it can use it for their land use maps, their use maps. Public Works can use it for running waterworks and other utilities. The sheriff's office can use it for tracking incidences of crime and other purposes that they have. But going on beyond that, your 911 services, when the call comes in on 911 and someone's sitting at a computer screen, the technology is now that they can actually look on the screen and locate where their emergency vehicles. The computer can track which one's closest, can estimate times to the caller. If you use the caller ID system, it'll pull up from where the call's coming, right where they're located. It'll track that and give the dispatcher information immediately on what vehicle is available. It will actually compute road times to the location, and now they're developing technology where if say your bridges are maintained in the field by say the county or whoever, if they're out there with a handheld computer and the bridge is out, they can change the bridge designation from open to closed and through the internet transmit that in so that automatically on the dispatcher's computer, it will show the bridges closed and reroute the vehicle. This is the kind of technology that's behind all of this, and we're trying to build the base so that others can use it. Another thing there is when we were visiting Avista Utilities, which is a natural gas company operating in Union County, Jackson, Josephine, Douglas, and Klamath, they were working on a software where if they get a call on natural gas leak at a home, they can dispatch information out to the computer on a truck, which will show the location of the home. And when they get there, they can pull up the actual site of the home and show right where the gas line's located with the pressure and the pipe and all the things the crew needs to find that and fix it. And they need this base so that the line will be where it is on the map when they start digging. It's useful for other purposes, and I'll just add one more, and that is in some cities now, for economic development purposes, there are websites where if you are interested in locating in a particular place, be it state of Oregon or wherever you want to start, you can indicate what you're looking for, like retail space, the square footage, and other conditions, and the computer will go in and show you the map and highlight sites that are available with photographs and everything else about the site, all the information, so that it's sort of a start for someone to know what's available, and then if they have, then if they're interested, once they see what's available, they can make some phone calls and engage it. This base that we're building is what makes a lot of this possible. So let me say the other thing is we have an advisory committee. We've broadened this much beyond property tax. Well, that's the main focus because we want to build this system so it's available for all of these uses. We have three county commissioners, a city administrator, the executive director for special districts, a county assessor, someone from Department of Forestry, someone from the Oregon Forest Industries Council, a representative from Portland General Electric, from the title company, and from the key federal agency, Bureau of Land Management. And they are advising Elizabeth and the department on good strategies for how to invest the money and build the space for Oregon. One that isn't mentioned here, and I guess it's because it's a regular part of our life, is the partnership we have with the counties in terms of property tax administration, and that is a very constructive partnership in terms of sharing duties and providing a statewide policy for our property tax system. Then on 1-48, we've just listed a number of some of the innovations we've done that helps increase our productivity, but to mention a first mention is one of the things we try to focus on is productivity not only for us but for taxpayers. In other words, we really don't want to build a system that creates an efficiency for the department and creates inefficiencies for the taxpayers where they're having to spend their resource and a lot of time to try to deal with the system. So one of those key things, and I've mentioned it, is electronic filing. Electronic filing, and that's, you'll hear more about that, is the volume is increasing. We're really pleased because not only is that more efficient for a taxpayer to be able to file their return and have all the calculations made correctly for them, but it creates efficiencies to our end. And when you toured the processing center, that's going to be a big help for us over time to reduce staff as more and more of this is done electronically. It reduces the errors that we have to deal with, and we just get a much better product for the citizens and for us. We've also, during the 90s, we've, because of the information we get from the IRS through computer tapes, we were able to eliminate the need for taxpayers when they file paper to file their federal schedules. That's particularly helpful for taxpayers that may have more complex returns. That way they have a less of a schedule burden for filing with us. We've also moved into electronic funds transfer for employers, and I think you heard yesterday that that's also becoming a bigger part of moving money. It's much more efficient and it's quicker, and so that's creating efficiencies both on the employer end and on our end. Internally, and you saw the remittance processing yesterday. I hope you get over, Madam Chair, to see that. That's really an interesting machine that runs the checks and the coupons through. We've worked on that to where that's becoming a much more productive element for us in terms of handling cash and getting into the banks. I'll mention one other thing, and that is on the property tax end, we do the large industrial plants, and we have been we've automated a lot in terms of the property tax returns that come in every year. The businesses have to file basically an update of their inventory, what they've removed, so it's not taxed, and anything new they've added. So we have a current inventory for tax purposes. We're automating that and have some things on the board to even make that more efficient. Right now, we're currently engaged in upgrading our core systems that we've built historically, and that should add even more productivity to our people in terms of our accounting systems and our systems that deliver, make our people more effective. The remittance processing, you notice that, I'll mention that again, that's also sort of at the what we're doing. Right now the machines we have will store the images of those checks and documents for 3 days, and we're upgrading that to keep that storage for 3 years, which will be much more effective for us. On 1-50, Again, here's just some visual graphics of it. There's the processing, as I mentioned, the documents through the 90s, the document volume has gone up, and the hours, total hours have gone down to actually process those because of some of this automation. Over on 1-51, when you track our productivity in terms of collecting dollars, we've marked there in 1992, we brought in an integrated tax accounting system, and that helped move that productivity up. What that does is for, say, for a revenue agent who's on the phone with a taxpayer trying to work out a liability, they can get accounting information and background on their account, so they don't have to be leafing through things. It's on the screen. They can deal with online. They can deal with billings. If they need to waive, they can produce waivers and refunds. They can generate a lot of stuff that used to take a lot of time all in one step with the taxpayer. The automated collection tracking that we brought in 1995 also helps them now because it can, number one, assign accounts, which is much more effective in distributing the workload with our revenue agents. It creates automated letters. It can create a system where if you set up an installment with a taxpayer, say they want to pay over 12 months, it used to be that the agent that had that had to go and check every month to see if they'd made their payment, to see if they needed to call them. Well, now the system will do that automatically, so it frees up the revenue agent. If they make all 12 payments, it's done, and the agent never handles it again. So it's those kind of automations that are actually help our people become more productive. That's also true on the bottom of 1-51 on accounts closed, which we also track. On 1-53, just some things we currently have going, and I've mentioned it's been mentioned. We are working on an intranet internally because we think that'll again eliminate a lot of the paper and move information quicker within our own agency. We will have telephone filing piggyback up this next year. And this next year, we're working on having also electronic deposit for taxpayers to get a refund, so we can deposit directly for them instead of sending them a check. We're also working on online return images, and what that will do is when we capture the information off the returns, we did have there is a technology we've been looking at for a year that's imaging that actually in a way takes an electronic photograph of returns so people can see it, but now there's a new technology that actually allows us to create the return on the screen, and the data will fill it in. Once we can do that, the good thing about that is right now we're still paper, so if somebody needs to see a return, we have to physically take the file and move it from one part of the department over to who needs it, like an auditor or a revenue agent, and now we can electronically transmit that. This is going to help us also move toward much more efficient file storage, because at some point we'll be able to capture the data and actually shred the returns and have it all stored electronically, which will make it a lot easier for everyone. All right, in the business area, we're working to try to provide, again, online registration for business taxpayers and return filing electronically. And that should help us on both ends. On 1-54, just in terms of the benchmarks, our key benchmark is number 33, which is the percentage of Oregonians who understand the Oregon tax system and where the money is spent. And I know for us observing initiatives and things in the state during the 90s, there's just a lot of confusion with people over where the money goes and how it's spent. So we've worked hard through a number of things to try to provide more information to people about at least the basics of how you spend the general fund money. And where that comes from. A survey in 1997 said that only 19% of Oregonians really understood both of these elements. And when another survey was taken, it went from 19 to 40% actually now understand that the personal income tax is the main source of the general fund. And 23% now knew more about the expenditure side in terms of especially public education. So we are encouraged by that, though we're going to continue to work to try to increase that public knowledge so that there's a better public debate over issues. 1-56, in terms of performance measures, we do track cost of documents filed. That's sort of a measure of our processing, and we have, over the 90s, have gradually reduced that. Now, once in a while, it'll take a bump up, and that's usually when we're making investments in the system, because it'll throw that cost in and throw the average up a little. But generally, the turn has been down, and we anticipate that will continue. Over on 1-57, in terms of our compliance efforts, particularly with our personal income tax system, we try to measure the where we are in terms of the money coming in and what should be coming in if we were in perfect compliance and with the law. We were down around 80%, and we've generally moved that up over time to 85%, and we're going to continue to work on that in terms of trying to get taxpayers to understand the law. We think on the education and help side, we can improve that just by helping taxpayers understand what the law is and helping them with their filing. 1-58 is property tax. We've had this measure, and by the way, we used to measure the amount of value on the roll as under the old system, but with especially with Measure 50 now, we're now reconstructing that measure because the value on the roll isn't as critical anymore with the Measure 50 limits. So we're working on another measure for property tax. This one actually is just an efficiency one, trying to track the accounts, and it did go up around the 97, and that's because the counties had to invest more because of the complexity of Measure 50 to try to readjust their systems and their computers. They also were working on converting their mapping, converting from paper to digital, and then they were hit with the PRS pickup costs and some insurance costs. So we did see a spike there, and those were really what caused that. We expect that now to level out and turn down again as we try to create more efficiency. That takes us to 1-60, just an overview of our budget history, and you'll hear more detail on that. But through the 90s, our budget's been relatively even, except last session, we had some packages added and some people to generate more revenue, and that pushed it up a bit. That new ORMAP, the mapping program, came on, so that added a bit to the other funds piece. And then the budget that you have before you now is up a bit more, again, because of some policy packages, primarily in terms of adding staff to increase revenue for you. You can see that on 1-61 is just a breakdown of the pieces of the budget from the last one to this one. And then on 1-62, you can see another breakdown in terms of the different things affecting the budget. And in there you will see, for instance, halfway down the program reductions, and then evaluation and county support is a package that's in there, the cigarette tax compliance package and the tax compliance policy packages are packages that are affecting the budget. Over on 1-63, you'll see actually in terms of positions or FTE what that does. It reduces us, the net is to reduce us by 3 positions, but in FTE terms it adds 10 FTE. 1-64 and 65 is just a summary, I've mentioned some of them, with information technology systems and how critical that is to where we're going in terms of being more efficient and delivering better services. We do have a large AS400, that's a big IBM type system, at our core for our accounting and other processes, and we also have personal computers and networks at the program level delivering a lot of efficiencies there. On 1-66, we want to know legislation that may affect the budget, so we've listed a few here. There is a corporation, and the corporation income and excise tax, there is a bill to move to a single sales factor as a way of apportioning income or determining how much taxable income there is in Oregon. That has moved from the, as over on the House side, it's moved from the Smart Growth and Commerce Committee to the House Revenue Committees, and there is actually, I believe this next Monday, the joint House and Senate are going to meet in Portland in a public hearing on this. That, as you can see, that has an estimated $136 million revenue loss attached to it. There's also a bill to eliminate the marriage penalty, and you've seen, probably read about that at the federal level. There's a bill in at the state level to do the same thing. That's in House Revenue right now, and it's they've had one public hearing on it so far. Refundable child care credit, that bill is also in House Revenue Committee and has had three public hearings so far. It's still there. On property taxes, there is an FCC license exemption that is passed on the House side and is over in the Senate and is now assigned to Senate Revenue. That is a sort of, it's a very small version of what last session was an issue over intangibles. This is just the FCC license piece. There is also another bill, and only because of its fiscal impact that we'd mention it, that would, it's a new measure of 50 limit, that basically allows, in its current form, allows taxpayers another chance to go back and get their 1995 values adjusted to try to decrease their 50 limit. Sort of opens that up for appeal. There's not, the next one, House Bill 3942, is not a property tax. There should have been an other heading for that. Representative Shetterly has a bill now that's had a number of public hearings and actually has another public hearing today. That is a package that would, I'll start at the bottom, establish a business activity tax, eliminate the corporate income and excise tax, create a refundable earned income credit, lower the capital gains rate, I think it's from the current 9% to 5%, and reduces the personal income tax rates. I think that would go from 9% to 8.5%. It bumped those down. Again, that's publicly being heard, and we don't know we don't quite have the revenue impact out of the Legislative Revenue Office on that. And we also have some bills coming through on this comes out of last session's House Bill 3575 in terms of converting our timber tax system over to more of a land tax. And then last, on the I-67 and 68, we've taken a much more focused look on the diverse nature of our workforce in the 90s. We've had some excellent groups inside of our agency come forward and want to work on recruiting. We found that diversity recruiting, you have to do some hard work on it to get people to come in and be interested in who you are and work for you. And we've had some excellent work done and increased our pools of people interested. We have an early morning networking session at 7:30 in the morning where, I don't know, it always amazes me. A lot of people show up and we talk about our agency. They're usually interested in some kind of our job openings, and we even walk them through what to do and help with their applications so that isn't quite as baffling. And through a lot of this work, we've actually been very pleased with the kind of people that have been joining our agency. And we think diversity, again, this is in the productivity section. We truly believe the diverse workforce will give us a much more dynamic interaction inside our agency over the views of our citizens and also help us to appreciate the different groups we work with. And that concludes the productivity section.
Committee? On the $1 added filing fee with the 99 legislature, did I see somewhere that raised approximately $2 million?
Yes.
That helps with the cost of the mapping? The map?
Yes, Madam Chair. That does. It raises about, right now it's running at about $800,000 a year. So it would be 1.6 to 2 million in a biennium. And that, basically what we do with that money is we're funding projects in the counties to upgrade all their systems, but at the same time, upgrading them in a way that they will all be able to interact with each other. So we don't end up with 36 different kind of systems that won't hook together. The overall scheme is to have that hooked together and not only with us, but federal agencies and state agencies. That's why they're all participating. So it'll become a valuable system for all of us applications.
You did say you were working with the e-commerce committee on the technology
Well, that, yeah, yes, we have a fit there.
Or the information technology.
And we're also working with the new, the state's new coordinator for all of this.
At DAS?
Yes.
Good, because I think I really get concerned if we have, if we could ever get so all agencies can talk to one another and communicate from one another, that will be great. And then have, having what you're doing with the map, or map you call it, that the more we can communicate statewide among all agencies, I think the better everybody will function.
Madam Chair, I'd just like to respond to that point that you made. There is a lot going on now in state government to bring agencies that previously had been sort of operating in their own little worlds together using technology. The Business in Oregon portal is just one example where six agencies have come together. Employment is taking the lead because they have more experience in developing that kind of a web presence. But we've got the Secretary of State's office, Corporation Division, which is business registry, us, which is business taxes, employment, economic development, Bureau of Labor, and Department of Consumer and Business Services, all working together on this web presence so that a business person can come into that portal and get whatever information they need about doing business in Oregon. And eventually, we're at version 1.1, but when we get further along, it will allow for interactivity of reporting, and ultimately, when we get down the road for the electronic payment through the web-enabled technology, if they'd like to use that to deposit their business taxes, they'll be able to do that. So the idea is to really get us to get our back offices working together so that people don't have to say, okay, now for this I need to deal with revenue, and for that I need to deal with consumer and business services, and I need to talk to employment about this thing. The other thing that's happening is the governor has convened, actually this started before with the year 2000 rollover effort, an information technology roundtable of 20 agencies that are the largest users of technology. And we also have a steering committee, a little smaller steering committee, that is working very, very hard with Information Resources Management Division of Department of Administrative Services to get that conversation going. How do we work together? How do we leverage technology resources? How do we avoid duplicating effort? How do we take advantage of agencies that have developed expertise and let them take the lead on some things and let others of us offload some other other work? So the combined payroll system that Jim described, which started many years ago between employment, consumer and business services, and revenue, is now starting to evolve into that joint web-enabled and technology work that I think you're going to be very, very pleased to see how much state agencies are starting to work laterally on these issues.
I'm already pleased from what I've heard, because in 1993, the committee I chaired, we looked at how many types of systems, how many types of computers. Somebody had Macintosh, somebody had Apple, somebody had Word. Nothing, you know, you couldn't communicate with anybody and across government agencies. And I'm just pleased that the governor's done this and spearheaded getting this all pulled together, because it really is a great thing to have us be able to talk to one another. Thank you.
Okay. Jim has concluded his presentation, and if, as we go through the more detailed work on program, if there are any questions that you have that come back to you from this, we're ready to field them. So I'd like to ask Susan Browning, who is the administrator of the Personal Tax and Compliance Division, to come forward. She's going to go over the income tax programs, which includes both the personal side and the corporate side.
We usually take a break at 9:30, but we got started a little late. Is it okay if we go, committee members, till about 9:45 and take a break?
Yeah, and we'll take a break now.
Susan, how long do you think you'll be? Half an hour or 20 minutes?
It's whatever you wish, Madam Chair.
Okay.
Depending on your questions, I don't want you to have to feel rushed either, though.
Committee members, are you all right if we go like 20, 25 more minutes and then take a break?
Okay. I can be interrupted anytime.
Susan, it's awful nice to see you, and it was nice to see you on the tour yesterday. Susan was my committee administrator when I had a committee in 93, and I thought she was charming then, and I think she's charming now. Good morning.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And members of the committee, for the record, I'm Susan Browning. I'm administrator of the Personal Tax and Compliance Division, and that's primarily the personal income tax program. As Elizabeth mentioned, I'm going to talk a little bit about the overall income tax system, so we're going to be talking about personal income tax withholding, and then a corporate income and excise tax. So please feel free to ask any questions as you go along or whatever strikes your fancy.
We usually try to wait till you're through, but if we have a question that just can't wait, we'll ask.
Okay. Burning desire. Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm going to start on page 2-2. In your booklet here. And basically, this is a profile of taxpayer compliance. And this is kind of a graphic version of what we call the tax gap. Elizabeth mentioned before that the tax system really is based on voluntary compliance. And this little graph really points that out. We're looking at the dollars that Oregon income taxpayers pay. And 89% of the dollars come in voluntarily. That's the big blue piece on this. Department of Revenue finds another 2% of the non-compliant found by Department of Revenue. That's through our audit and collection and filing enforcement activities. The 9%, the yellow piece, is what we call the non-compliant piece. And this is an estimate that our Department of Revenue research staff puts together. And it includes people underreporting their income or inaccurately reporting their expenses or deductions, or those who just don't file, the non-filer piece. So it's all of that. That's kind of the picture of where the dollars are based on our best estimates. Then as you take that piece and move into page 2-3, it shows how the money actually comes in. And here we're focusing on the pale blue and the big blue piece of 2-2. 79% of the money actually comes through withholding an estimated tax. And that really points out to the Department of Revenue the importance of the withholding system. Most wage earners, obviously, are under the withholding system. So that's a very easy, efficient way for both the state and taxpayers to meet their tax obligation. Because at the end of the year, they should be pretty close to, we hope, zero amount of tax to pay. And if they keep up with their estimated payments, they will as well. And the 19% actually send in their tax due with a return. And then this little yellow slice is just it corresponds to the light blue slice on the other page, is the 2% activity the department is involved with, the audit and collections. And of that, most of the money, 1.7% of that, comes in through either billing letters. We generate 2 letters automatically to taxpayers, reminding them they haven't paid or they owe, and asking them to send their money in. And that generates a lot of response. And then, in addition, after that, it's turned over to a revenue agent, and he or she will call the taxpayer and talk with them about the situation. And oftentimes, that's resolved through a payment plan, where the person just needs a little bit more time to pay their obligation. So you can see that the bulk of the money does come in either voluntarily through the taxpayer paying or withholding or estimated tax, or easily resolving it through payment plan or just sending in a check. There is a 0.3% of the total amount of money that's non-voluntary. That's where the Department of Revenue becomes involved with garnishments of either wages or bank accounts, checking accounts, that type of activity. So that's where we're starting to take more assertive collection action.
Senator Dukes.
Just a curiosity. I used to hear about people filing mostly federal, but I think some to state, income taxes and withholding a certain amount of the payment in protest of something that we spent money on, defense, abortion, something. They'd say a certain percent of the budget is for the military, and so we're not going. Do we get any of that?
Madam Chair, Senator Dukes, we do have a small percentage of those people that on principle are opposed to paying some type of money towards some type of activity. We do pursue collection on those people. Oftentimes, to be very honest, it's difficult, because there's a very strong principle involved, and so they will be very resistant to it. But we do feel it's important to try to collect it.
Generally fall into your 0.3%?
Yes, Madam Chair, Senator Dukes, that would be that's the kind of the far end of the tax-paying public, where, as I say, once you get your personal values involved in this, it's very difficult to because it's not a matter of ability to pay. It really is, I don't agree with this. We'll talk a little bit more about that, too, because we have a group of people we call, or they call themselves, tax resistors, and those are probably one of the biggest challenges we have to work with as we go through the system. And we talk a little bit about this on page 2-4. Elizabeth mentioned before about we really have a balanced approach to income tax systems that the Department of Revenue is pursuing, really looking at supporting people who are trying to comply with the tax laws and then work with those who aren't meeting their responsibilities. And the majority of people are Just need a little help or training to be successful. We can provide technology for those who are interested in it. Electronic filing has been very helpful for those people who want an easier way to do it, faster way to do it. But as we look at strategies on how to improve compliance with the tax system, we really need to look at the reasons behind why people don't comply. And Senator Dukes pointed out one of them, one of the more difficult ones, actually. And as we look at these, we've got just little bullets about some of the major reasons we see why people aren't complying. They don't understand. A lot of times high school students get their first job. They're not really aware of what they need to do and how to do it. We have, as all of us are aware, we have a lot more Spanish people joining our workforce who don't necessarily speak English as a first language or have much experience with the tax system, so we need to help work with them. And then we move into procrastination, people who, well, they plan to get around to it, and they just haven't. And you start putting things either throwing away or putting it in shoeboxes. And if this goes on for a period of time, it's very hard to get yourself back in the system. If you've done this for 3 or 4 years, the possible punishment is pretty scary. So those people we need to work with this too. Financial problems and personal problems, issues where people have been filing and paying all along, but then they have some kind of problem with a divorce, job loss, medical problems, and there's just so much going on in their life, they kind of fall out of the system for a while. We need to help them work through it and get back in to resolve those issues. Just don't want to pay is what we classify the next group. There's a variety of people in there. The people who don't report all their income, they inaccurately report their expenses, their deductions, or they just don't file because they just don't want to pay. They don't really have the money. We have always heard instances of people who have, you know, driving Mercedes. You hear these little anecdotes of driving Mercedes who aren't paying taxes. Well, we all need to file and pay. It's our obligation, our responsibility. The tax resister is the type that is the most challenging. These people have principles. We get correspondence from tax resisters who say they're sovereign citizens. They do not have to pay taxes, and they feel strongly. And there's some rhetoric, especially with the Internet now, because people can gain access to a lot of more information and the words and language and can fall prey to that. And those are difficult ones to work with. So we really need to look at why people aren't complying and try to meet their needs or give them a...
Dave Hayden.
And what strategies are you taking to deal with or accommodate the tax resisters?
Madam Chair, Representative Hayden, we look pretty closely with the IRS on the tax resisters. The department does not classify people as tax resisters. They write correspondence to us, and they include this kind of rhetoric, or they start talking about principles and those type of things. We work strongly with the IRS to identify these people and take collection action to stop it. The concern, Representative Hayden, we have with these individuals, some of them are just doing it personally because they personally don't agree with it. Others really promote their concepts and convince other people of what they're doing. And those are the people that are really we want to deal with and get them to stop doing that, because some of them are fairly persuasive and they can convince people who otherwise would have been paying that, yeah, there's some logic to what you're saying when there isn't. So we have information and brochures that we provide and try to stop people that are getting into this philosophy, I guess you'd say, before they get into it too far.
Representative Hayden.
Well, with some people who have strongly held personal beliefs, not that they shouldn't pay taxes, but they shouldn't pay taxes for this particular thing that government is doing, it would seem like the unions, you might take a leaf from the unions. The unions said, well, there are workers who have strongly held beliefs against joining unions, so they can pay the equivalent of union dues to a charity. Perhaps the revenue department could take the same position. All right, you don't want to pay taxes on, you mentioned abortion. You can pay that money to the Red Cross or something like that. You would need statutes to do that. But I'd be interested to know if there's some way to accommodate people who have strongly held personal opinions that government might do well to respect. Thank you.
Thank you.
Dukes. Probably because I'm from a border community, we hear a lot of complaints by people who work in Oregon but don't live in Oregon. that they have to pay our taxes. I've always assumed that they finally just went ahead and paid them, and there are corporations that do business in Oregon that don't live in Oregon either, that don't seem too excited sometimes about paying our taxes. Is there any noticeable percentage of out-of-state folks? Do we have a higher incidence of them than of Oregonians who aren't paying their taxes? I always assumed we didn't, but I...
Madam Chair, Senator Dukes, I'd be happy to go back and look and see if we have any statistics on that. I know that's something we're really aware of. We do put on educational seminars and workshops up in the border areas, so people...
It's great, so they understand where that tax money goes.
Mm-hmm. So that's something we'd be happy to look into and see if we can provide you more information on that. Madam Chair, members of the committee, on page 2-5, it's just a graphic representation of what we talked about a little bit earlier about the relationship of education, assistance, and enforcement, and how it all supports our business of compliance. And I want to talk with that, I would like to talk about each piece of this a little bit more for you. On page 2-6, we start talking about education and assistance. And I've listed for you there just a variety of ways we attempt to meet taxpayers' needs. We all receive information and want to participate differently, whether it's depending on we want paper, we want to do by phone, or in person or electronically. The Information Processing Division Administrator is going to talk with you more about the electronic piece, so I'm going to just touch upon some other pieces of it. We do still send out lots of booklets. The numbers are actually falling, though, as more and more people do use the Internet to get information and to do their filing. And telephones, you see, we do get many, many calls through our tax services unit, 367,000 calls per year. And one of the things we've done this last time is to have our new audit class, our new auditors, go down and help answer questions and phone calls to give them a real sense of what the issues, the concerns, the problems the taxpayers are having. So it gives them a little better insight as they go out and audit. They've had this kind of frontline experience from people. The in-person activities, I wanted to touch upon that a little bit. We've really expanded our customer assistance days, and those are the ones where we go out and actually meet with the public and answer questions, hand out forms, and help them with their tax filing to meet more of our Spanish-speaking community. We have a bilingual staff and who are going out and doing that piece of it. I want to touch a little bit on tax aid. Tax aid has been very successful. That's a joint project with AARP, Department of Revenue, and Internal Revenue Service. We're actually AARP sponsors it, and individuals go out and help low-income, elderly, and non-English-speaking taxpayers fill out their forms, so actually can sit down and take your information. It's been a great experience for the Department of Revenue. The Department of Revenue provides the training for our staff, and then the employees volunteer their own time, so they go on their Saturdays or evenings to help. And so one way for them to really connect with the community and see people in that environment. Mentioned a little bit about the training we put on for new businesses, employers, as well as the small business fairs. There's a major annual business fair up in for small businesses in the Portland area every year. And last year, in one day, we had about 270 business owners, small business owners, talk with the Department of Revenue about their obligations as a business owner for filing their taxes, and especially if they have employees. You enter a whole dimension when you add employees to your business that people need to oftentimes have a little help with. Electronic filing, I know Jack Ogami, our IPD administrator, will be talking more about that, but one little anecdote I wanted to share with you on that. You can see the numbers that are being filed electronically, but we got this little email from a taxpayer, and all she said was, e-file is awesome. I thought that was pretty nice.
That's good.
It's nice to hear that kind of response. On page 2-7, I give you an example of some of the information. I have included some examples of things so you can see what we're doing as part of our education assistance efforts. 2-7 is, and 2-8, we have both of these in English and Spanish. These actually are a brainchild of one of our field offices, and these flyers are posted in high schools, DMV, Department of Motor Vehicles, employment, high schools, community colleges, and the grocery stores. And they've been very successful. It was interesting, the grocery stores, I guess I never made the connection, how popular they are as a community source of information, especially in small towns. We sent out surveys, about 300 surveys, to people we did to the places where we had these posted last year, and about 200 people responded and really liked this idea. And one grocery store owner said it saved him a lot of time by directing, not having to have his staff direct people to where to find these forms. So that was kind of an eye-opener that grocery stores are a good place to post information for the general public. And then on 2-9, this just gives you a little summary that we hand this out to different groups so that they can plan and schedule their times with talk to their community about when we can actually get help. We have Hispanic Help Days where we will, through Mano a Mano, and Jim and Mary mentioned that a little bit earlier. We have Customer Assistance Days. We do jointly with the IRS where we have that piece of it. And we have Mall Days where we actually go out and have our staff in the malls and cities throughout the state to help people with their questions. And really, this is a piece that we're really gearing at people who want to comply but just need a little help and some information and get a little boost to start doing that. And we also work up in the Portland Federal Building with the IRS. We have done that for quite a while. And, of course, we have our website address down here, too. We have a great deal of information out there on the web, and we're trying to get people to use that more because that is such an efficient way for people to get information and to make sure it's correct. Not just working out. Page 2-10 and 2-11 is something that was developed by one of our employees, an administrative specialist, one in our filing enforcement program. She really saw, she dealt with people who've fallen out of the system, the people we talked about, job loss, medical problems, whatever. She saw a real issue when people get a divorce. A lot of times they don't think about what does that mean for them as the taxpayer. Maybe the spouse is the one who always handled the taxes, so they don't really have that as a recognition. And so this is just a little reminder that as a taxpayer is going through divorce, just to think about that and be prepared to file. So this individual, she put this all together. She took this on as a project. She put this all together, and she's been working through the state court system and with the IRS to get them to agree to put it in their little packet of information when people go in and are working through the divorce process. They'll have just a little reminder. Don't find yourself in deep trouble at this point. Try to plan ahead. So I thought that was a really innovative little project she did. Pages 2-12, 2-13, these are just some examples of taxpayer assistance we're doing in our field offices. We have these 6 field offices. We also have new satellite offices, one-person offices in Coquille, Pendleton, and Newport. And those 3 individuals in each of those areas are basically available to speak with the community, give them assistance, and the same kind of things we do in the bigger field offices. A couple things I want to mention on these, just I had highlighted a couple areas here. Bend and Medford especially have found that, again, getting back to the grocery stores, that one of the really effective places to set up for taxpayer assistance as well, not just post the information, but in small towns especially, is the grocery store. And Medford went to Brookings Century Market, and I guess they were really very popular there. So it's interesting. You wouldn't think having, but in a small town where you need to find a place where there's some tables and people can sit down and talk and get forms, there's sometimes limited resources there. So that was one area they found where they could, because easy parking, easy access. So that was kind of a clever idea they came up with. Medford also has, at the request of their local television station, they put on a panel, basically, with our employees, and just answered questions from the viewers. And that went so well, they were asked back for a second time. So it's an interesting thing to call in with their questions, kind of a tax telethon, I guess. But it was an interesting concept and was very successful. In Portland, they're working with the Asian community. They're the Laotian Chinese and speakers as well as Russian speakers because of the population mix they have up there. Okay, and on 2-14, the third pillar in our compliance, we've talked about education assistance, and the third pillar is enforcement. We do need to work with people who aren't in compliance and determine that they are applying correctly the statutes and Internal Revenue Code to their circumstances. And we do that through audit, filing enforcement, and collection. I think audit, we just basically review returns for accuracy and work to make sure that all items are reported correctly. I wanted to mention, I have a little improvement pieces in here too. On audit, the audit area, we're working on a new tool for our auditors. We're calling it ACES, which is Representative Butler's not here, but I'll spell it out. It's the auditor's computerized examination system, and this is going to really automate their work papers so that they can provide clearer output to the taxpayers and more information and do it more accurately and more timely. The filing enforcement staff, basically they work to identify people who are not in the system, who haven't been filing, and to estimate how much those people have as far as income, withholding, and their tax due, and then they work to bring those people into compliance. We just brought up a new program for them in 2000 called the Filing Enforcement 2000 program, and that really melds a lot of information from different sources to improve their accuracy and make sure we represent withholding correctly and some of the other pieces. So that's been very effective as well. And then the third piece, once we go through audit and filing enforcement, is the collection piece where we attempt to resolve the tax debt. And we start with the billing letters we talked about, payment plans, and then if necessary, we will go to administrative legal processes, which include garnishment. And we have a couple of things we're looking at in the collection area as well, including automated asset searching and revision to our payment plan processing.
Okay, before you go into that next section, I think we will take a 5-minute break and we'll be back in 2 minutes.
Thank you, Madam Chair.